The Book Nook on WISO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Microsun Lamps.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WISO. I'm Vic McCunis. Since I began hosting this program back in 1994, I've had the opportunity to interview a lot of authors, and one author in particular has made more appearances on the program than anybody else, bar none. His name is James Lee Burke. The first time I interviewed him was back in the mid-90s, and he's been back many times since then. In fact, the next time I interview him will be interview number 16. Well, back in 1999, he still did book tours. He used to do a lot of book touring, but he has stopped. He really doesn't do book tours anymore as he's gotten older. And Jim was on his way to Dayton for a book signing. He was with his wife, Pearl. He didn't fly. They drove everywhere. And they were at a gas station in Lima, Ohio, on their way to Yellow Springs, when they had a little technical problem. Apparently, they were going to switch drivers. And so one of them lobbed the keys over the hood to the other one, and the keys landed on the hood and went down inside the vent. And there was a little problem. They couldn't find their keys. And so Jim honored the interview. He called me on a payphone, and he did the interview that way. We talked about his book, Heartwood, back in 1999. Here's James Lee Burke.
Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO, and it's my pleasure to welcome James Lee Burke back to the program. He's got a new book out. It's called Heartwood, and this is another in the Billy Bob Holland series. And last time Jim was here was with a book called Cimarron Rose, which was the first book in the series. Welcome back.
That's right. Well, thanks a lot for having me again, Vic.
How you been? What you been up to?
Real good. Staying on planet, you know, things like that. I have simple goals.
You still commuting between Montana and Louisiana?
That's right. We have a home in New Iberia, and then, it gets pretty hot. We head back up to old Montana.
Now, I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with Dave Robichaux and that series. For those two or three people out there that aren't familiar with that one, tell them about it.
Dave Robichaux? Well, Dave Robichaux is the protagonist or narrator in 10 books, I believe, set around New Orleans and New Iberia. He's a detective with the Iberia Parish Sheriff's Office, and he's a character of whom I'm quite fond. Billy Bob Holland is an ex-Texas Ranger and currently a defense attorney who narrates the novel Cimarron Rose and the new book Heartwood.
So you've spun off another series, and that Cimarron Rose book, you did pretty well with that. Didn't you get an Edgar for that one?
Yeah, it received an Edgar, and it made the New York Times bestseller list.
Not too shabby.
Well, I feel very fortunate.
Tell us about this new book, Heartwood.
Oh, it's set in a little town up in the Texas Hill Country, and it deals with some Mexican gangbangers, the Purple Heart Gang from San Antonio, as well as a guy named Earl Dietrich, who is really a bad guy. He's a very wealthy bad guy, though. And a fellow who is antithetically mixed, but he descends from neo-colonialists, people who own diamond interest in Zaire. It's a pretty interesting cast of characters. It's my most ambitious book, the best book I've published, I believe.
Well, you have a lot of characters here, and Billy Bob is very conflicted again, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. He becomes involved with Earl Dietrich's wife. She was his first love, Peggy Jean.
I had never heard of a heartwood tree before. Is there such a thing?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, tree grows from the center outwards. It grows from the heart of the tree. The heart of the tree adds a layer at a time. And Billy Bob, when he's baptized by immersion at age 9, is told by his dad that the trees along the stream are heartwood trees, and they draw their strength from the coldness and the purity of the water. But for that reason, he tells Billy Bob always has to keep his roots in a clear stream.
This character that you bring in, is it Wilbur?
Wilbur T. Pickett.
He's a real interesting fellow.
Yeah, he is. He's a ex-rodeo man who's trying to get into the oil business. And, of course, he gets into it with Earl Dietrich. But his wife, who is a blind Northern Cheyenne shaman, she's a prophetess, she has the gift of Cassandra, owns a piece of land up in Wyoming that's got oil on it. And Earl Dietrich wants it. And Wilbur T. Pickett's got the core sample in a big jar, and he says, "Man, that's sweet crude you could eat on ice cream."
You've also got a really bad guy who's the sheriff.
Yeah. He's a bad guy, all right. This fellow with one lung smokes 4 packs of cigarettes a day. Yeah, he's a truly disgusting, loathsome human being.
And this conflict in the town is something that was a big part of the other book, Cimarron Rose, and it's just getting worse, isn't it?
Well, it's, you know, the nature of our society. I mean, I'm 62. I was born in the Depression. But we're living in Darwinian times where the discrepancies between the rich and the poor have grown. I mean, that's a statistically demonstrable conclusion. The middle class is shrunken. But there are more and more of the have-nots, what people sometimes refer to as the underclass, which is no longer racially defined. And then there are enormous sums of money being made by people at the top. Not criticizing that fact. It's just a fact. But, I mean, there are people amassing Midas levels of guilt, wealth.
That was a Freudian slip,
Freudian
Jim.
Slip. They don't feel guilty. But I just think about it. My heaven's sakes. It's just, we used to think that Ross Perot was pretty well off with his measly $3 billion. And now that looks like chump change. Poor Ross will be on food stamps next. Well, look. Just think about it. Here's a fellow with $3 billion that was just pushed out of his organization by a professional wrestler. I mean, if $3 billion can't keep you your job in the organization you founded, you're in trouble. $3 billion doesn't mean a lot anymore.
Now, that's not true. Now.
But that's an incredible conclusion, isn't it? He's saying the guy's worth $3 billion and can't keep his job.
Well, you know, you don't have to read books to find surreal things.
I voted for Ross in the primaries. I'm not making fun of it. But, I mean, it's just, you know, history plays great jokes on us.
I love hearing you laugh.
Oh, thanks. There's a light side to all of this. You
know? Now, you bring in the element in this book of this woman who's blind and she can see things. And then you also bring back the element of Billy Bob's partner and that whole grim story of back in the days in old Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
This guy. Really keeps Billy Bob out of a lot of bad situations, doesn't he?
Yeah, Billy Bob's partner in the Texas Rangers was a fellow named L.Q. Navarra. And Billy Bob and L.Q. made these unauthorized raids down into Coahuila, and they killed drug traffickers. I mean, they just assassinated them and would stuff a playing card emblazoned with the badge of the Texas Rangers into the mouths of the dead. However, the upshot was, in a firefight, Billy Bob accidentally killed LQ, his best friend. And the specter of LQ goes with him everywhere. The ghost, the spirit is always there.
And LQ turns up more frequently the more trouble Billy Bob gets into.
That's right. LQ is a loyal friend. He is. He's a good character.
And you find Billy Bob fantasizing and wishing that he had LQ's gun.
That's right.
It's really a strong connection. It never goes away, does it?
That's right. Every time that Billy Bob gets in a situation, and he's an attorney now, and he's renounced violence, he feels the old ways, the old temptation come back again, and his hand literally aches to curve around the ivory handles on LQ Navarra's double-action 45 revolver. He just aches to smell cordite again. It was clean, it was simple, but of course it was wrong too. And that propensity for violence in Billy Bob cost the life of his best friend.
What's the process for you when you write? What do you do? How do you do it?
Well, I try to retain the dreams I had the night before. I know that sounds peculiar, but somehow the scenes for today, should I be writing today, were in my sleep the previous night. And I write in longhand before I go to bed at midnight. And I wake up with images and scenes in my mind. And when I start in the morning, everything's there. And I aim for 500 to 1,000 words. And I do it that way every day. Each morning I rewrite what I wrote the day before. But I'm able to produce a book a year, what I hope is a good book a year. And I've been real happy doing it the way I do it.
When you dream, do you dream about your characters or do you just have images?
Oh, just all kinds of things, scenes. I wake up in the middle of the night with lines of dialogue. It's just the story's in the unconscious. You can't instill it. It's just there. It's either there or it isn't there. And for me, it's always been there.
So you have like a little pad there on the nightstand?
Yeah, that's a big pad. I got a big legal pad.
That's really a great gift. Are you writing when you're on book tour, or do you shut it down?
No, it's hit it and get it. No, we just roll all the time, Pearl and I, my wife. You know, we're out 1 month this year. We're doing, I think, 17 cities this year. We used to do 30, but it was just... I was getting over the hill for it, I guess. But that's a lot for anybody. It doesn't matter what age you are. 30 cities, big tour.
Now, you're not a big flyer, are you?
No, we drive.
Okay. So you have to focus on a particular area, and you kind of stick around that area?
Well, no. We go all over creation.
Do you?
Yeah, we go everywhere. We used to, in 1 year, cover the whole country, San Diego to Boston, Toronto to New Orleans, Vancouver to Miami. We used to do the whole continent.
What, you got like a big Airstream trailer you're riding in?
No, my Avalon.
Really?
Billy Bob and I both were driving Avalon. Yeah, the angels fly with us. I have papal dispensation to speed.
James Lee Burke is here. He's a... Got papal dispensation and a great new book. It's called Heartwood. And I'm wondering, are you superstitious?
Well, I don't think so, but I mean, it's like asking a short, fat man if he's short and fat. He's probably not going to hurry to agree with you.
I mean, do you have like little idiosyncrasies like, you know, about the way you do things? Do you have like a routine that you follow? Or,
well, I have a routine. I never break it because if you do things by rote and you set up a certain standard and you never alter what is a successful regimen that you impose upon your work ethic. The chances are you're going to be successful at whatever you do, but you never allow anyone to influence it. And you have to be hard-nosed about it because the temptations are always there. Someone says, oh, come on, take a day off. You know, you can do that. Well, you can't do that. And if you're going to be an artist, you have to live your art. And if you work for yourself, you have to be a hard boss. You can't join the union. And, you know, it's like... you make a contract with some power outside of yourself. That's really what it amounts to. I think as an artist, you come to two conclusions about your life. Number one, that you have a gift and the gift was given to you by some entity outside of yourself. Number two, that gift is there to make the world a better place and you have to make use of it in the time you have. You can never take it for granted. That it becomes theologically a sin, virtually, to, in effect, indicate to yourself or to your higher power that you have taken tomorrow for granted, you see. I used to have a friend, a redemptorist priest, and I'll never forget something he said to me once. He said he had sat by the deathbed of many a parishioner, of course, in his lifetime. And he said, believe me, Jim, people do not regret their sins at their deaths. They regret what they did not do with their lives. I never forgot that.
You describe the use of drugs by some of your characters. Uh-huh. It really rings true. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you come up with this stuff? I mean, do you talk to people? Mm-hmm. Do you imagine this stuff? I mean, you're talking mm-hmm. about
yeah.
a type of marijuana from a certain area in yeah. Mexico mixed yeah. with something else, you know,
yeah.
and I'm saying to myself, now Jim Burke is
yeah.
not using this stuff.
Uh-huh.
How's he come up with the idea to even talk about it?
I was a social worker in South Central Los Angeles. I lived in South Central, and all the kids in our neighborhood were in the gangs, every one of them. They could not survive unless they belonged to the gangs. Now, these were all Mexican kids. And the East L.A. Purple Hearts was one of those gangs. And they were Gladiators, Choppers, Clanton 14, Arañas, the Spiders, the Viscounts, that was a white gang. Lordy, I can't remember the names of them all. They were all, of course, divided along ethnic lines. The Gladiators and Choppers were black. Now, these guys have all been replaced by the Crips and the Bloods. Now, the situation has not really changed, except for the introduction of narcotics on a much more serious level and far more sophisticated firepower. Years ago, these gang members had only shivs and chains, pipe guns. They call them zip guns. Today, you know, they use Beretta 9 mics, maybe M16s that are burglarized from National Guard armories. They've got some really serious stuff, you know, in their possession. Street sweepers, you know, they fire 12-gauge shotguns from drum magazines. Tech Nines. There's an outfit in Denver that sells hell triggers, that's what they're called, for Tech Nines that are manufactured in Florida and can be fired almost as fast as a machine gun. They're made for drug dealers, for gang members. You know, they're made to be fired in rooms at close quarters. So, I mean, this is pretty dangerous stuff, but you're right, it's narcotics, in my view, that has just had a devastating effect on the people who are most vulnerable to narcotics and who have the greatest amount to lose.
Are you talking about back in the 60s you were working in L.A. doing that?
Yeah, I worked there in the 60s. My wife taught at Manual Arts High School in South L.A. Manual Arts was written up in educational textbooks as the worst school in America. That's right. It was that bad. Man, I mean, that was one bad school.
Were you just starting to write at that point? Or?
No, I've been writing quite a while. I had written Half of Paradise, my first novel. I hadn't been able to publish it. But in Los Angeles, I met a veteran of the Lincoln Brigade, a guy named George Poole. He was a novelist, and it was through George that I was introduced to an agent in New York who sold Half of Paradise. It took me 5 years to get it in print. But I started writing it when I was 20 and finished when I was 23. I published my first short story in 1956. I mean, that was 43 years ago.
Was that in a magazine?
Yeah.
Wasn't like Argosy or something like that?
No, but I tried Argosy. I used to write a lot of stories when I was a young writer and send them off to these great men's magazines. There was Mail.
Uh-huh.
There was True Magazine, Argosy, Hexaga. Was that another great men's magazines?
I remember seeing those on the newsstand when I was a kid. They always had really good covers.
Oh, man. You, Five Alarm Fires. You could not walk past the news rack without picking one of those up. You'd see a guy on the cover. He'd be bare-chested, standing up to his hips in the Amazon River under attack from piranhas. And there'd be crocodiles swimming toward him, a Nazi submarine surfacing in the middle of the river, a Japanese Zero strafing him. How do you compete with art like that, man?
Those were the days.
I made it. The country was far more innocent back then.
I have to wonder, Jim, when you read for your own pleasure, what kind of books do you read?
Oh, I just recently read Eusebius's History of the Church. He was a 4th century Roman historian. It's a great book about what ancient Rome was like. It's written by a guy who was there. Gee whiz. What's interesting is you read the book and you say, it's us. Nothing has changed. Same players. Same 5 percenters. The guy's always working an angle. Same sleazy characters. The saints, the martyrs, the heroes. It's. But anyway, I also recently read Joe Klein's biography of Woody Guthrie. Boy, it's a great book. I didn't know Joe Klein was a biographer. You know, he wrote Primary Colors. I just finished.
I thought that was written by Anonymous.
Yeah. I read, John Neihardt's daughter's book about the writing of Black Elk Speaks.
Oh.
It's a great reminisce about the year 1931 and the months they spent with Black Elk. And I knew John Neihardt very well. I was a good friend of John Neihardt. We used to fish out at his farm, my wife and I, in Missouri. And he had a great influence on my work. Black Elk is one of the greatest works in American writing. Everybody who writes about the West will concede he owes a debt to John Neihardt. That stylistically, everybody goes back to Neihardt, the way he described the sounds that horses make, his use of the land almost as a character, the mystical quality that seems to animate the physical world. Nobody comes close to Neihardt. The closest book I know to Neihardt is Fool's Crow by James Welch. Yeah, but Neihardt is the titan. A.B. Guthrie, you know, wrote Big Sky. I read a lot about the West. I love the Western United States.
But you're also, from the sound of it, a bit of a literary omnivore. It sounds like you go a lot of places to read.
Yeah, I read all the time. What else did I just read? I read True at First Light, you know, the posthumous Hemingway publication.
Is that the one of his relatives is just
the son Patrick, I believe, edited it, and I assume that it was published with the permission of all three sons.
Was it any good?
Well, I owe a tremendous debt to Ernest Hemingway, and I was a good friend to Lester, Ernest's brother, but I think it was not wise to publish this book. I don't think Papa wanted it published.
Mm-hmm.
And it it will mar his reputation. That's it. That's what's unfortunate. It will mar Hemingway's reputation. He wrote it toward the in the last decade of his life when he was not well. It's obvious in the manuscript, you know, he's impaired and and it's well anyway.
Now here was a man, Hemingway, who was so much larger than life. I mean, you hear about the legends about that guy. Whether they're true or not.
Yeah. He's a remarkable man. And every writer, I think, working after Hemingway has been influenced by him. It'd be impossible not to be influenced by him. Screenwriting was influenced by him. The simple declarative dialogue. Every writer of crime fiction was influenced by him. One of the best crime stories ever published is The Killers. That's a masterpiece. There's never a violent act in that story, but you never get it out of your head. You feel like pure evil walks into that diner in Upper Michigan. It's just like you're watching the Garden of Eden destroyed by these serpentine characters, Max and Al. Golly, it's a great story.
When he was a kid, he used to go on vacation up in that area, didn't he?
That's right. Uh-huh. Yeah, up at, was it Horton's Landing, I think.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm looking at the clock, Jim, and I'm seeing that we've already been talking for about 40 minutes, so I guess we're going to have to close out this edition of the Book Nook, but I highly recommend your new book to our listeners. It's called Heartwood, and James Lee Burke has been our guest. Just a real treat to have you back.
Oh, it's a treat being here. Thanks a lot, Vic.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And that was James Lee Burke on The Best of the Book Nook, recorded back in 1999, back when he still did book tours. And Jim is still going strong. We had him on the program last December for his most recent Dave Robichaux novel. It's called simply Robichaux, and I think it's his best book yet. And it just came out in paperback, if you haven't read it. And he has a new one coming out. He keeps on that schedule, a book a year. And his new one will be out this coming January, and I'm reading it right now. It's another Dave Robichaux. Jim had taken a hiatus from the Robichaux character. He hadn't written a Robichaux book in a number of years, and then he came back with this amazing Robichaux novel earlier this year in January. And now here's another one. It's going to be called The New Iberia Blues, and I'm halfway through it right now, and it is a very interesting Robichaux novel, very dark, just like the one before. So James Lee Burke hopefully will be back on the program again coming in January, and that will be my 16th interview with James Lee Burke, if we can make it happen. We've got 15 so far. And he really is one of my favorites. When you hear him laugh, how can you resist joining in? His daughter told me a really funny story one time. She's a writer too, Alifair Burke. Jim was in the Catholic Church, and they were sitting there listening to the sermon, and he started laughing about something. And everybody around him started laughing too. What a wonderful man. For the best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.